Today's program that we entitle All the News is really, well, the title at least, is a takeoff on one of the most honorable slogans in American journalism, All the News That's Fit to Print, slogan of the New York Times. This is a slogan I'm sure that is dear and near to the hearts of most men in American journalism. Today, however, we're not talking about the New York Times, not even talking about the full slogan. We are talking about whether all the news that is available does appear in the American press. Now let me introduce my guests for today. My first guest is Mr. Herbert Brucker. Mr. Brucker is editor of the Hartford, Connecticut Current and chairman of the Freedom of Information Committee of the American Society of Newspaper Editors. My second guest is Mr. William J. Miller. Mr. Miller is the chief editorial writer of the New York Herald Tribune. And my third guest is Mr. I.F. Stone. Mr. Stone is editor of I.F. Stone's Weekly that is published in Washington, D.C. Mr. Stone, I think it's only fair to say that you are one of the most outspoken critics of the American press when it comes to this question of whether all the news does appear at one time or another. And I wonder if you would just begin, this isn't the way we usually do, but just begin with a statement of your own views as to the possible motivations for what you maintain is a refusal to print all the news.
Well, I think there are three things wrong with the American press, a very good press, I think, better than that of most countries except perhaps England. Like, we have a very good press. But the three things wrong with it are these. First of all, as soon as you get away from the Eastern Seaboard, there are very few papers in this country that run enough news matter to make possible a considered judgment on public affairs. The average city daily does not run enough news. That's the first big criticism of it. Second thing is that newspapers, and of course to a greater degree radio and television, are adjuncts of advertising. Advertisers object to ideas that might disturb anybody. So there's a tendency not to spread wicked ideas or bad ideas, but no ideas, so as not to upset any possible customer. And the third thing is that since it takes a lot of money to own a newspaper, except a small one like mine, most publishers are Republicans, and when the Republicans are in power, they tend to be just a little extra stuffy in the hope that Ike will ask them down to one of his stag dinners. Those, I think, are the three main reasons why the average reader of the average American daily just doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't get enough news. It's just a matter of news volume.
Let me ask Mr. Miller, Mr. Brucker, let me begin by asking Mr. Miller how he would reply to what would seem to be quite an indictment.
I think his first indictment is well taken. It's certainly true that aside from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and the Des Moines Register Tribune, the St. Paul papers, by and large, the broad continental newspapers do not tend to give enough foreign news and a rounded treatment of the news. On the third indictment about, or rather the second, on advertisers, I would simply say that one of the most successful publishers in history, Mr. Scripps, refused to let an advertiser advertise in the Cleveland press because he wanted to dictate the news policy. And a year after that, this same advertiser was begging to get back into the press. I think there are perhaps are some publishers who...
He's been dead a long time.
Lean over backwards to avoid offending advertisers. But I believe the greatest and the most successful feel that the news must come first, and the advertisers will respect them if they take that position.
Mr. Brucker, how do you feel about this?
Well, I would agree with both Mr. Stone and Mr. Miller. I think, though, that the advertising pressure is exaggerated. I know that it exists because I have felt it. But I don't think that really accounts for the lack of our printing as much news as we should. I think there are two factors there. One is economic, these rising costs we hear about all the time. There just isn't room to get in enough. And then when it comes to shading it, I don't think it's so much because the advertisers object as because newspapers are pretty expensive operations in themselves nowadays, and they tend naturally, of their own accord, without anybody telling them, to have the same attitude toward economic and political matters as the advertisers.
Well, I think there are two questions here that, as a layperson, I say. One is the question of the, let's say, the size and scope and content of a newspaper. If you gentlemen agree that with some major exceptions, when you leave the Eastern Seaboard, you're not going to get, by any means, even a fairly full treatment of the news. That's one thing. I suppose that's physical.
If I may interrupt, Mr. Yeah. Hefner, I wouldn't even leave out the Eastern Seaboard because with the exception of New York and Washington, I think our smaller papers here are essentially the same, almost to the same degree as the smaller papers out in the Middle West and the Far West that they don't print enough.
All right, let's more or less accept this. I think you gentlemen agree on this. But when you get to the other area, you get to the area of what I would call suppression of news or an unwillingness to print the news that one knows about and one could print in terms of the physical capacity of the newspaper plant. What about this? Do you feel, as Mr. Stone does, that there is considerable, it's my word, suppression?
I don't. I'd like to pick up one thing Mr. Stone said. He said we had a pretty good press. I think we have the best there is, even better than the British, because while they have the Times and the Guardian and a few others, they also have their big mass papers that I think are cut worse than ours.
Sure.
We have a pretty good press, but I don't think that we really suppress very much for economic or political reasons. We're the inheritors of a great tradition that was developed in the last two-thirds of the 19th century and since then, really, that the news should be presented objectively. And obviously you can't get it all in. You don't, but I think we do a pretty good job. I think one of our difficulties nowadays, and that's something new, is the difficulty of getting the news, let alone having it and refusing to print it. It's quite a problem, particularly in matters of national defense, for example, to get the news.
Well,
it used to be taken for granted. All you needed was freedom of the press, that is, freedom to publish, because you could get the news. Nowadays, with our exceedingly complicated government and defense structure particularly, and the huge bureaucracy that government is, you've got a new problem, and that's to get it in the first place, to find out what's going on.
Mm-hmm. See, Mr. Stone?
You all spoke about suppression. That isn't what I said.
I know. It was my word. I was careful.
There's very little
that.
Suppression by advertising. Advertisers don't know very much about what's going on. They have very little interest in public questions. What advertising, what the commercialization of radio, TV, and papers does is to tend to smooth it all out because advertisers don't like controversy. They don't want to offend anybody, whether he's a radical or a conservative.
But how is this done if it isn't through suppression of news?
Oh, no, it's done in much subtler ways. The suppression, I can name you since Scripps's time, for example, the Philadelphia Bulletin, the Washington Star, who have resisted overt pressure by an advertiser. There's much more suppression of news today, or rather distortion of news, by pressure from the government than there is from any advertiser.
All right, this has been Mr. Brucker.
Admiral Straws and John Foster Dulles are on the phone all the time with leading editors. Whenever some reporter gets out of line and prints something they don't like, Straws is chewing the boss's ear off. This is true of the New York Times. It's true of the Washington Star, which is also a very, very good paper. Of course, the Times is the greatest paper in the world. Criticizing it, I'm not derogating from its greatness. But it's the government has much more to do with distortion of news today than any commercial or economic interest.
Well, let me ask Mr. Miller, who represents the other great New York newspaper and maybe the other great American newspaper, whether you think that there is an attempt to put the pressure on when news that or information that the government might consider undesirable to come out at one particular moment, whether there is a pressure on you, on the Herald Tribune, on other newspapers.
If it exists, I'm not aware of it personally. I would say simply, as far as the Tribune is concerned, that at the time of the Sputnik ascension, I don't believe any paper in the country was more critical of the indifference and perhaps blandness of the administration at that particular time. We call for many additional actions that were not being taken. I think Mr. Stone's criticism of blandness perhaps applies more to the society in general. I think that we have reached a state where controversy is avoided on all fronts, much to the detriment of good old-fashioned indignation, outrage, and debate.
Do you think that... All right, Mr. Stone.
See, we like to think of ourselves as individualists, but the truth is there are very few individualists left in this country, and the publishers are among the least individualistic. On the whole, the great days of a Hearst, a Pulitzer, a McCormick, these, for all their differences of points of view, were men of real ideas and who thought about things, whether rightly or wrongly.
Yes,
the average publisher today belongs to the country club, and all there is in his head are the cliches and stereotypes of the country club locker room.
That's quite a generalization.
Yeah,
I think you'd probably take it back in very many instances, wouldn't
you?
Yeah,
but unfortunately, it applies just about 90% of them. The editors have to go along with people who are, in many cases, uninformed, uneducated, poorly educated.
Yeah, but
you
said you didn't want to use the word suppression, and yet you described a situation that you feel exists, that when a newspaper man has the working stiff,
it's
has
not
gotten some news...
It's something so much worse than suppression. It's a situation in which reporters in Washington, who do have a lot of enterprise and intelligence and a lot of bright guys there, go stale and cynical and sour because the head office doesn't care. They don't want a complicated story. Nobody gives a damn about it.
Yeah, but
this.
I'm asking you a particular question.
This is
question.
The way in which the blandness is reflected.
Yes, but the particular question that I have in mind is, do you mean then that there are stories that have been gathered by the working members of the press, that they have been submitted to their newspapers, and that the editors and or publishers refuse to print this news?
Oh, I don't think it's that simple. By the time a guy gets to be important in the paper, he knows what he can write. But there are many different. For example, the lack of news volume has a very interesting effect. It means that when there's an important exchange, international exchange, the ordinary reader of an American newspaper, all he gets is a couple of sticks that tell him what the State Department spokesman said the day before. There isn't room for the text. There isn't the material which you can study the thing on your own. So all you get is the cud rechewed by the State Department. They hand out their line. They hand out a line just the way the Russians do. They don't get away with it as much as Russians do, but they hand out a line. They manipulate the press.
Is this because there just isn't room in the press, as you were saying, outside
there
of
the... There is because, first of all, most papers rather run advertising than news. For very good reason.
Survival.
And the second thing is that there isn't much interest. And the third thing is that there are certain... Now, for example, with the New York Times, Admiral Straws and John Foster Dulles are two sacred cows of the Times. You cannot be well informed without reading the New York Times. With all due respect to the Herald Tribune, which I also read every day, and which I value for many things... It's indispensable, but there are certain areas in which the Times is not reliable, and those are the areas in which, with exceptions, Straws, the AEC, and Dulles tend to be a sacred cow.
Yeah, well, I didn't want this to become a discussion of the New York Times,
there is
because
suppression.
We don't have a
if you
Times
want to talk about
answer.
Suppression, there is suppression and there is distortion. A very striking example was the way the Times handled the business of the Alaska, the underground testing. Now, I broke the underground test story. I never would have been able to break it if it hadn't been the New York Times, because I remember that last fall, when the Times ran its story from Nevada on the underground test, the Times reporter said that it had conformed to the predictions of the AEC experts that it could not be detected more than a couple hundred miles. That same morning, the Times had shirt tails from Tokyo, Toronto, and Rome, saying that seismographs had picked up the test. I thought, gosh, if I only had the money to cable those places and check and find out. And I was hoping the Times would do it and never did. Then when the AEC, a couple of months ago, issued its formal report saying it hadn't been gotten more than 250 miles, I called the AEC and said, how do you reconcile this statement with the fact that the New York Times, the morning after, last September, said that Tokyo, Toronto, and Rome had gotten it? They said, we don't know what the answer is. We'll call you later. In the meantime, I discovered from Coast and Geodetic Survey that a wide band of 19 stations as far north as Alaska and as far east as Fayetteville, Arkansas, had certainly detected it. They were dubious about Rome, Toronto, and Tokyo.
When you broke the story,
the Times didn't run that story.
Yeah, but when you broke it finally, it did appear, and I don't think there was suppression.
It didn't even have appeared then, except for the
Senator
fact...
Senator Humphrey.
The AEC did not even issue a regular press release. What they did, after they heard I'd been a Coast and Geodetic Survey, they called back and said, Izzy, there's been some mistake. Coast and Geodetic says it was heard in Alaska. We'll give you a statement Monday. On Monday, but only to those reporters who knew about it and asked for it, which one other guy whom I had tipped off and myself, got a little frigid statement. If Senator Humphrey hadn't issued a blast the following day, the big papers of this country would never have run the story. And even so, it was distorted because the Times said it was an honest error. That misses the whole point. The real point was, it might have been an honest error. The real point was, and this is, none of the papers have brought it out, that the man who protested the false sentence and took ill, and the man who got the telegram and took a leave of absence, all this peculiar set of coincidences which are possible. All they proposed to do was to take out the false sentence. Nobody in the AEC proposed to tell the truth.
Now, Mr. Brucker, how do you react to this?
About
well,
this test.
I am not aware of the fact that the newspapers deliberately left some of those things out. But what Mr. Stone said brings me back to where I was before, that I think one of our principal difficulties is getting the news, and the AEC and the Defense Department, possibly the State Department, are prize examples of where it is difficult to get the news. It's so complicated nowadays that the independent paper, even the Press Association, has difficulty in getting it. The only way you can get it is to go to headquarters, the people like the AEC who have the authoritative information. And if you have very little to go on, there's not much you can do except take what they give you. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is one of our basic troubles nowadays. It's particularly noticeable in Washington, where there's always a tendency to consider not something has happened, the American people ought to know about it, but something has happened, it's very important, it's very complex, how can we present it to the American people? And that's, I think, where... A screen is put up outside, and they think that we're doing this job, it's our job to do it, we've got to prepare the people. Therefore, we can tell them only so much. And I think that's where one of our great difficulties comes in.
Nowadays. Mr. Miller, what do you feel about that?
I agree with Mr. Brucker on that, and incidentally, I would like to congratulate Mr. Stone on a fine job of reporting in this instance. I'm glad that he had the ingenuity and the initiative to go after the story. Our own people, we have five or six men in the Washington Bureau who have to cover everything that is happening there, State Department, War Department, Defense, scientific developments. It's humanly impossible, as Mr. Brucker says, to reach to touch every base every day. Not even the wire services can do it. And the news did get out in this instance, thanks to you. I would seriously question if there was any deliberate suppression. I think that they were aware that they had recorded a shock, but they were not clear as to whether it was an atomic shock or a normal earthquake.
Well, I think that again, as a layperson, I would want to ask you, Mr. Miller, whether here there are two things, it would seem, again. One, the possibility that the men assigned to Washington did not do the kind of digging, maybe didn't have the kind of memory that Mr. Stone has. Secondly, the question of suppression. And you feel, I gather, that this was not an instance of suppression, either on the part of the newspapers or on the part of the Atomic Energy Commission.
I personally don't think so.
Do you think that this question of suppression does have a place in an examination of what is to be found in American newspapers today?
The question of suppression is a very intricate and subtle question. Because the papers were widely criticized during the McCarthy period for playing McCarthy's charges as much as they did. And I've heard people seriously suggest that the newspapers were responsible for McCarthyism because they would give big headlines to his careless and unsubstantiated charges and thus feed the fire, as it were.
Mm-hmm. How do you, Mr. Brucker? Go ahead.
I was interested in what Mr. Miller said about that. I've certainly heard that accusation that the newspapers are responsible for McCarthy, but I don't see how you can defend that very well, because after all, it was something that was terribly important to this country, And while many of us bitterly opposed him, we had to recognize that he articulated a widespread feeling among the American people, and therefore I think it was right to give them the attention that he was given in the press. And in due course, as events changed, that came out. I still go back to this thing that our problem is particularly in these important national and international matters to get the news out of the people who know in our complex society. And I think it's material and important there that there is now before Congress, and it's through the House and is probably going to go through the Senate, a bill that will open one little door. That's known as the Moss-Hennings Bill. It's addressed to the government offices in the Executive Department who have been hiding behind a 1789 statute that merely set the government up in business and said there shall be offices and they shall keep records and so forth. That has been used as an authority for withholding news from the American people. This bill would simply add a sentence to the effect that this section shall not be used to, I forget what the wording is, to justify the withholding of information from the American public or the closing of records to them. And as I say, that's already gone through the House. I think it's going to go through the Senate. And if the President signs it, that is going to, I think, be a beginning on doing what is necessary. I think we're always going to have to fight that battle to get the doors open in our increasingly complex society so that we can find out these things.
Well, what specific changes do you think this is going to bring about?
Well, it'll simply, you see, what has happened is that the various government departments have had this attitude that I spoke of Papa knows best, we want to manage things, we want to prepare the American people, therefore they withhold a certain amount of information depending on what their problem is. And then it's only since the war, and the American Society of Newspaper Editors was prominent in this, began to ask, under what authority do you withhold this news? Then their lawyers began to scurry around, and they discovered this 1789 law and said, this is our authority. So what this would do is take away a legal reason for withholding news. They would have to find some other reason. And, of course, there isn't. Anything affecting national defense or income tax information, crop reports, all of these things, wherever there's a legitimate reason for secrecy, it's written into specific legislation. And what we want to do is to clear the general field up so as to get away from these things we've been talking
about. Yeah, but now we spent two programs when we were talking about our courts and a free press, listening to lawyers maintain that there are certain constitutional rights, let's say the right to a fair trial, these rights are violated at times when the press's desire to maintain its freedom, its total freedom, is given precedence over the right of a fair trial. Now I'd ask the question, well, we've been sitting here damning governmental suppression of news or refusal to give out news. What about the notion that it is in the national interest at times to suppress news and to provide one picture when all the news might present another picture?
I think you'll find the newspaper is going along that. The problem is the other way around. And this question of the courts you speak of, a fair trial is one right, free press is another. Neither one can override the other. But I think our problem is that the courts are, after all, in control of the bar and the bench, and there's a pretty strong and powerful group there that is upholding that one right of a fair trial to the exclusion of the other. I think the newspapers come in, and they have to come in. Not that they don't believe in the right of a fair trial, and not that they want a right of a free press to override it to the detriment of somebody who's not getting a fair trial, but that that element is so suppressed that there has to be a lot of energy put behind it so that the free press cannot override but come up equal with the right of a fair trial.
Mr. Brooker, break in?
Stone?
I think your committee's done a wonderful job on this Moss bill, and I think the American press has done itself proud in that fight. I'd like to put in a plug for a pet crotchet of my own with you as a member of that committee. One thing the newspapers could do to help in this situation is to refuse to take off-the-record interviews. When a public official has something to say, he ought to say it in his own name. Now, what they do is they call in a reporter, they flatter the hell out of him by admitting him to the presence, They give them a lot of stuff that they would never dare to say in their own name. They use it as a trial balloon. They disavow it. They use the reporter. You don't know whether it came out of state, out of Sherman Adams, out of Defense Department. You have no way of evaluating it. And there are a couple of bureau chiefs in Washington. Ed Leahy of the Chicago Daily News is one who will not go to private dinners. Another curse. Dulles has a lot of guys to private dinner. They're flattered to death. And so they retail a lot of stuff that they wouldn't retail if they weren't so flattered. Mr. Dulles has a right to be heard, but he should speak in his own name and not anonymously.
That's a terribly difficult problem, and I know that, as you know, there are a lot of reporters who have adopted that attitude. It's awfully hard to figure, because sometimes you can get some information that way that is useful background that will explain something else to you, so therefore there's even a moral reason for going along with it. But then there is that terrible risk that you will be tied up and that you will be used. And I'm afraid it's going to be difficult to get as individualistic a group as the ASNE to adopt any general policy on that. They each like to play it by ear according to their own lights. Some of them do that, and I think probably more of them should.
Can I say a word about McCarthy, what Mr. Miller said?
We've got 1 minute left. If you want to say it, go ahead.
Well, I think it's important. I think it'd be a terrible thing for this country if newspapers began to print things or not print things because they thought it was bad to print it. I think the newspapers were right in covering McCarthy. What ruined McCarthy was more coverage and not less, and their TV, by letting the people really see him whole in action, really ruined him.
It was the Army McCarthy hearings that were the beginning of the downfall.
I agree with that.
More coverage and not
more
less.
More coverage and not less.
You mean all the news has got to be out on the table?
Including a news that a lot of stuffy editors think isn't fit to print.
You think that in the last 10 seconds, you think this bill is going to change anything, really, if the pressures do not subside, the other
not
kinds
very
of pressures?
Much, just a little
it's
bit.
Not going to change much. It's a small thing, but an important one.
Well,
beginning.
Thanks so much for talking about this beginning of the question of all the news. Thank you very much, Mr. Brucker, Mr. Miller, and Mr. Stone.